Puget Sound is defined in a variety of ways depending on who you're asking. If you ask the most oceanographers, they'll tell you it's everything south of Admiralty Inlet. For people who are in a regulatory position, Puget Sound has been defined by the legislature as everything from Cape Flattery to the Canadian border. Some oceanographers take offense at the legislature defining Puget Sound, but that's the way it is and that's the way it's regulated today. Puget Sound is the one fjord in the 49 states outside of Alaska. It has a connection of connecting basins and sills in between. There's a major sill here and a major sill right at the Tacoma Narrows. And in between are deeper basins. If we take a look at the cross section of the sound, same figure I had up the other day, you can see that Puget Sound is very deep, 900 feet at its deepest point. Here's the sill in the north at Admiralty Inlet. Here's the sill in the south at the Tacoma Narrows. The area between Admiralty Inlet and Tacoma Narrows is called the Main Basin. South of Tacoma Narrows is called the South Sound. North of Admiralty Inlet is the North Sound. And I'll be using that terminology a little bit in my talk today. There are about 2,000 square miles of water area in Puget Sound, and the drainage basin surrounding Puget Sound has about 14,000 square miles of land area. There are about 75 river systems that drain into Puget Sound. Today I'm going to be focusing mainly on the marine portion of the Puget Sound Basin, and the only reason for that is a matter of time. I was up there working on my computer and I decided that the terrestrial stuff was not going to make it today. I know a bunch of you are Puget Sounders and you of course know a lot about the water temperature. It's about 45 degrees Fahrenheit in winter at the surface and about 55 degrees Fahrenheit in summer at the surface. At depth, it's about 43 degrees Fahrenheit year-round. Chilly. Puget Sound has a shoreline of about 2,350 miles, which creates a diversity of habitats around that shoreline. Now, of course, since it's so deep out in the Central Basin, there's not a lot of what we would traditionally call habitat. But remember, there are a lot of open ocean or pelagic fish and other species that live in this deep water, even in the Central Sound. There are even bottom critters that live in the very deepest parts of the sound as well. If we take a look at the species that are there, Puget Sound is really, really rich in species. This is a chemist's view of the biology of the sound, so I can use these numbers a little bit loosely, unlike I'd use them if I were talking about chemistry, probably. But there are over 200 different species of fish, 31 species of waterfowl, 57 species of shorebirds, about 7 species of marine mammals that are commonly present in the sound, either as migratory marine mammals or as resident marine mammals, and somewhere on the order of 21 other species of marine mammals that occasionally come in the sound or rarely or accidentally come in the sound. And then, of course, all kinds of invertebrate species. And then we don't want to forget the other part of the food chain or food web. The macroalgae, like sea lettuce and fucus, the big stuff. And then the little critters, the zooplankton, and at the bottom of the food web, the phytoplankton. Phytoplankton is absolutely critical to the whole web of everything above it. And Puget Sound is considered to be the richest estuary, cold water estuary in the world in terms of phytoplankton production, which gives us a lot of this richness of species above. If anybody has any questions, please feel free to interrupt me.
What's a phytoplankton?
Phyto means plant. Plankton is small. So they're the little tiny one-celled organisms that depend on sunshine and serve as food sources for for the little tiny microscopic animals or zooplankton, which may be tiny in their adult form or may be tiny when they're in their larval form. For instance, various species of shellfish, well, all species of shellfish and many other invertebrates start out free-floating when they're just when they're eggs and in their very smallest larval form. So they're microscopic, so at that point in their life cycle, they're just kind of floating around, either right on the surface or in the water column, as little free-floating organisms. And then, for instance, with shellfish, they settle down and fix on something or dig into the bottom sediments. Okay, in terms of the list of habitats, this is again a list, a fairly generalized list of habitats that might not thrill a marine biologist, but these are the habitats that I want to talk about. So it's not an exhaustive list of habitat, but it does have a lot of the most significant habitats on it. As I said before, the open water of the Sound, the bottom or benthic habitat, which can be anything from the finest mud all the way up to boulders. A very, very significant habitat, particularly important in soft sediments, eelgrass beds, which I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about. They can either be under the water or subtidal, or they can be right at the waterline or intertidal. Wetland habitats, which are intertidal, which includes salt marshes, the intertidal eelgrass, and then the unvegetated mudflats. Mudflats may not be pretty to look at, some people may not think they're pretty to look at, but they're super important to the overall Sound ecosystem. And then the rocky intertidal habitat, which actually I don't think I'll spend much time talking about. So there are a variety of kinds of marine habitats. Many of the critters that live out there move back and forth between these habitats during their life cycle. So it's not like you can lose one habitat and still have all the other habitat types unaffected. Let's talk about the open water habitat first. It's a critical area when it comes to feeding for a whole variety of species, particularly the pelagic or free-swimming open water organisms. And that includes those little critters, the zooplankton and phytoplankton, that then serve as food source for bait fish, things we like to catch, herring, smelt, sand lance, all the species of salmon and steelhead, ground fish or bottom fish, including hake, pollock, and cod. And as I already mentioned, the Puget Sound region has the highest richness of phytoplankton of just about any deep water estuary in the world. A cold water estuary in the world. And it's a major, the open water is a major contributor to the overall food web of the Sound, including, of course, to us. Lots of those larval species that later settle down and become fixed in the bottom live in the open water during part of their life cycle. Benthic habitat. A diverse set of organisms can live in benthic habitats, and it depends a lot on the substrate or bottom type. Soft bottom species that live in the muds in the bottom, of course, includes worms, sea squirts, starfish, some species of clams, flounder, halibut, and sole. Many of them either feed by filtering out small organisms, or they feed by eating the stuff that's been deposited on the bottom. So many of the soft benthic species, the species that live in soft benthic habitat, are either filter feeders or they feed on the stuff that settles out or the detritus that comes down from above when organisms above them die. In coarser sediment, gravel and cobbles, of course we have a lot of species of clams that like to live in them. Those kinds of organisms either dig in the sand around the gravel and cobbles, or they may hide between the rocks. Also in this habitat, we find a lot of copepods. Those look like little shrimp, and they're a major food source for juvenile salmon. Rocky habitats support plants and animals that can grip onto the rocks or, again, hide between the bigger rocks and boulders. And those include things like leafy sea lettuce, many of the brown rock weeds, red nori, giant brown kelp, and a lot of species of invertebrates like sea anemones, mussels, starfish, crabs, and shrimp. The fish species that live down there include rockfish, sea perch, and lingcod. Okay, moving on to eelgrass. In eelgrass, we have shallow, soft-bottom communities that are often characterized by a lot of green grass-like material that's about that wide and perhaps about that long. And it provides a super productive marine habitat. Lots of little critters can hide in the eelgrass. Now, not a lot of them eat the eelgrass per se, but they eat the critters that live on the eelgrass, and they also eat the pieces of eelgrass that get broken off. Likewise, bacteria can live on the surface of eelgrass, lots of larval forms of fish. Actually, their eggs are attached to eelgrass, and an excellent example of that is herring eggs. When herrings spawn, the eggs stick to the eelgrass and begin to develop. The little fish begin to develop in that eelgrass. Estuarine, of course, includes vegetated salt marshes. These are, of course, again, important nursery habitats where salmon may rest for periods of time as they're on their way out to sea. Likewise, the intertidal eelgrass, and then a particularly important area, the unvegetated mudflats, the area that we're most likely to dredge or fill because people view them as being kind of ugly and don't think about the critters that live there. The unvegetated mudflats are particularly important for shellfish. Many of us have been out in that muck digging shellfish, as well as fish and particularly shorebirds and the little organisms in the unvegetated mudflats that shorebirds eat. Let's now take a little look at fish stocks in the open water and see what's happened to them. This is some data that goes back to 1911.
Whoa.
And it shows what's happened to commercial landings of salmon in Puget Sound. Now, this is all species of salmon. And, some people question whether this data point is really 40 million. But even if it's half that, at 20 million, there was still a pretty dramatic decrease right about 1911. Anybody know what caused that decrease? It was a natural disaster. It was a major rock slide on the Fraser River that really decimated a specific Puget Sound fish run. And that specific Puget Sound fish run was the sockeye. If you take a look at the sockeye data, you can see that there was a huge sockeye fishery that absolutely crashed after that rock slide. Now, sockeye has continued to be what's a pretty minor commercial fishery and also recreational fishery in Puget Sound. Anybody know why? We don't grow sockeye in fish hatcheries. And so the natural run of sockeye is basically what we have.
Why don't we grow?
They're hard to grow. They're a fish that's pretty sensitive to disease. They're real picky about conditions. They're just hard to grow. Also, we don't have as much expertise in growing them because they're hard to grow. So it's just plain not done. There are a few small efforts, but for the most part, they're not grown. And we'll get to a little bit more later on when I talk about marine mammals, but that's why the sea lions at the Ballard Locks have such a major impact on the sockeye fishery, is because the sockeye fishery is completely dependent on wild stocks. So nobody's coming along and supplementing that fishery. So when the sea lions munch on a few sockeye, and there aren't very many left, it makes a big dent. Now, if we compare that to coho over the same period of time, now notice we changed the scale. In the last two scales, we were on the order of 22 million for the sockeye and 40 million overall. Notice here we're on the order of 1.7 million landings of coho. Notice that the coho decreased essentially until fish traps were eliminated in Puget Sound, plateaued out, and as hatchery production began, the coho number of coho landings went up. So the key here is banning fish traps and increasing hatchery stocks. If we were to look at wild stocks of coho, the situation would be almost identical to that of the sockeye. So in other words, hatchery stocks are what the bulk of our fisheries are today, a whole heck of a lot of our fisheries are today, with a much less dependence on wild stocks. Take a look at Chinook. And again, the numbers are smaller yet, but the same kind of pattern. Now let's look at a little bit shorter time period for commercial landings. This is the top, oops, that's herring. There's salmon. Shorter time period for commercial landings. And you can see that commercial landings are really basically pretty stable with maybe a little bit of increase here in the 1980s. And this is all forms of salmon that are commercially caught in the Sound. And if you looked at recreational landings, you'd find that they were pretty similar to this. Interestingly enough, part of this increase out here, and the increase appears to be continuing, is due to Native American fish hatcheries coming online and adding to the overall fishery stocks of the Sound. But the reason for this stability is very tight regulation by the Department of Fisheries in terms of the commercial landings and Department of Wildlife in terms of the recreational landings of steelhead species and non-commercial fish, and overall, you know, a pretty tight lid on how fish are caught to make sure that there's an adequate escapement or an adequate number of fish that can get upstream to either be spawned at hatcheries or to spawn wild in river and streams. Anybody here have any comments on fish stocks, salmon and trout, salmon species? Yeah.
Why do you believe that a level, or maybe you don't, but why is level good? I mean, wouldn't a natural stock be something other than a certain one?
Essentially, the way fisheries and wildlife sets their allowable harvest rates is by estimating the overall number of fish. So they're allowing enough to escape to keep the stocks level. You make a really good point. You know, why don't we want to see them continue to increase? There are two reasons.
No, why not?
Cycle.
Why aren't waves the way that it might happen? And is there a way to know what the natural environment might provide?
When you look at wild stocks, habitat is decreasing every year. Places where those fish can spawn is decreasing every year. So wild stocks are still tending to decrease. Hatchery stocks are basically a capacity for the fish hatcheries. Hatchery stocks have a higher survival rate because, of course, if they're that long before they're dumped in a river or stream, whereas, of course, wild stocks start out as eggs in a river or stream. So they have a lot higher mortality rate. But genetically, hatchery stocks tend to be more inbred, and because they're more inbred, they may well not survive as well in the long run, which is one of the reasons for wanting to keep wild stocks to improve your genetic diversity. Hatcheries have also had a big problem in the last several years with a couple of viral diseases and have had to kill a lot of juvenile fish. I have a friend who's a manager of a fish hatchery for Department of Wildlife, and I was talking to him at dinner a few weeks ago, and he estimates that he's had to kill 5 million of his juvenile fish in the last 3 years because of viral infections, which is a very distressing thing to do, to have to kill most of the fish in your hatchery.
Why are there so many viral problems?
That's a fine question. There are no easy answers to that, but it could be because of less genetic diversity in the fish stocks. Also, the disease has moved into this area, and there's no good, they're just coming up with vaccinations for it. And of course, vaccinating little salmon is not a trivial matter. I mean, they do things like that. You like vaccines that you can dump in the water rather than giving a fish a shot.
They actually let the fish shot.
They also clip their fins.
Each fish, they did it.
Yeah, well, to identify the fish in the hatchery. They'll clip their fins so they know where they come from, where they come back, when they're caught, where they came from. They also, in some cases, implant little pieces of metal in their heads, or of course, tag them. Some way of identifying them. Clipping the fins seems to be the easiest, the simple way, and does them less damage. Just a little aside here. Because I know, well, I'm really interested in salmon, and I know a lot of other people are too, and I said I wasn't going to talk about freshwater and upstream very much, but I just wanted to point out what salmon and steelhead need. Up the streams, they really need overhead cover, both overhead cover at water level and a canopy above. The overhead cover provides them protection for spawning and foraging. The vegetation overhead helps prevent the water from heating up and also, of course, prevents erosion. One of the most significant problems with erosion is siltation in the spawning beds, so that the little eggs get smothered during the course of beginning to grow, and of course then you have no salmon. Clean, cold, well-oxygenated water helps prevent disease, among other things. Interestingly enough, if salmon are exposed to water above 65 degrees, at the point when they're ready to go to sea, when all those physiological changes start to take place, they're exposed to temperatures above 65 degrees, they forget to go to sea. And they remain in the fresh water. They can't make the physiological change to go to sea. It's a little bit of an aside, but that's one of the reasons that the cooling tower was built on the Trojan plant on the Columbia River. If the Trojan plant had been able to dump its hot water into the Columbia, it's very likely that the temperature of the Columbia would have been such that a major population of fish going down the Oregon side wouldn't have bothered going on. Of course, clean, gravelly stream beds, adequate amount of water, adequate stream flow so they can get there and survive, good food supply, and wetlands areas for resting, rearing, and food. And particularly when they're getting down to the mouths of the rivers and streams, when they're trying to make that huge adjustment from going from fresh water, where of course they're trying to keep salt in their little bodies, to going to salt water, where their bodies are less salty than the water around them, and they're having to pump salt out. And those gills have to make a major change in going from fresh to salt water. So this adequate wetland area is the place where they're undergoing that very major physiological change. Anyway, if we look at landings of other fish, such as herring, you can see that herring have taken a real nosedive in Puget Sound as well. And one of the reasons herring have taken a real nosedive, people believe, is because of the reduction in eelgrass beds, particularly intertidal eelgrass beds, where the herring spawn and lay their eggs. And those eggs, like I said, attached to the eelgrass for part of their life cycle. Another part of this may be due to overfishing.
Why are there eelgrass beds?
What?
What's caused the eelgrass beds to
Well, the latest eelgrass, major eelgrass bed to go was the eelgrass bed in Elliott Bay, which is right by Seattle. And the new marina that's going in Elliott Bay put fill on top of the last remaining eelgrass bed in Elliott Bay. It's the only place we could put a marina in Elliott Bay.
Was that known and discussed in an environmental impact statement?
Absolutely. In detail.
Huh. Why'd they ignore that? Why'd they ignore that?
I didn't consider the hearing as important as the economic development.
That's right. That's right.
Boring.
That moorage was more important than an eelgrass bed. Now, when you do something like that, one of the things a developer can propose is mitigation, or trying to build some other kind of habitat elsewhere, such as trying to build an eelgrass bed somewhere else. Unfortunately, we don't have very many places where you can build an eelgrass bed, where conditions are right in terms of water circulation, etc. And many attempts at building eelgrass beds have failed. There's a good example of one that failed fairly dramatically just north of Blaine, Washington, right at the Canadian border, where Canadian researchers tried to build an eelgrass bed. It was a total disaster, but interestingly enough, just north of there, an eelgrass bed did form on its own. It was as a result of changing bulkheads and stuff, and they put in some bulkheads that were perpendicular to the shore. And the area where they tried didn't work, but the area above it did it by itself. There's some examples in the South Sound where people have tried building eelgrass beds and basically taking coffee can-sized plugs of eelgrass and plumping them down in the sediments, and they haven't taken. Yeah?
Do you understand this proposal in Snohomish County where some developers want to buy a berry farm that is along the Snohomish River and restore it to habitat and use it as a bank to sell for $20,000 an acre to developers who want to destroy wetlands in other areas?
That's called off-site mitigation.
What's your opinion on something like that?
I can think of very few off-site mitigation projects that have been successful anywhere. And in general, I oppose off-site mitigation. There's some cases where a project like the one in Elliott Bay is going to happen anyway, and you might as well try and extract some money out of the developer to do some off-site mitigation somewhere with the idea that it might work. A better way to do it is to actually get the developer to purchase land elsewhere that's in a healthy state,
right,
so that that land is essentially protected for all time, you know, given to the state or whatever. Well, it may or may not be protected for all time. The state might decide to sell it, but at least it's in public ownership.
Well, I think it's going to happen.
Yeah. There are a lot of schemes like that all over the Sound right now. There was one in Kitsap County where they wanted to build a Costco in the last remaining wetland in Paulsbo.
Ugh.
And that was blocked, successfully blocked. The Costco was put somewhere else. But if you look at, for those of you from Washington, look at Silverdale, for instance. A very large part of the rapidly growing area of Silverdale was once intertidal wetlands or nearshore uplands that kind of acted as a buffer to those intertidal wetlands. And today they're covered with strip development. If we look at the whiting stocks in Puget Sound, and the reason I pick whiting is not because I have any love for whiting particularly, but because they're easy to measure because they're a schooling fish, and they can determine the size of whiting stocks by using sonar. And the whiting stocks appeared to have an increase in the mid-1980s, pretty much unexplained, and a decrease in the late 1980s, likewise unexplained. Could be fishing, could be pollution, it could be reproductive failures, nobody knows. Unfortunately, there was data has not been collected on the whiting stock since 1987, and that's very typical of non-salmon species. Nobody collects the data. And that's one of the things that we're trying to get in place through the Puget Sound Monitoring Program is to get people out there collecting data on fish stocks. So we know how many rockfish we have. And we know how many wingfish, to get an overall picture of trends of what's happening to fish.
Some species appear to be going up, and again, there's no idea why. And it's just a couple, and I unfortunately didn't write down what they were. I can look them up later on. The Puget Sound Update, which is a report published annually on monitoring results, mentions a couple of species in this last one that actually had gone up.
Who does
it? It's done by the Puget Sound Water Quality Authority on contract from the Environmental Protection Agency. Well, those are fish species. Let's take a quick look at marine mammal species. The marine mammal species that live in Puget Sound include seals and sea lions, baleen whales, and toothed whales. This is the three general categories. Harbor seals are pretty common in Puget Sound. From 1900 until 1960, both harbor seals and all species of sea lions had a bounty on them paid by the state of Washington. It's estimated that about 17,000 were killed for bounty. In the 1970s, both the state of Washington began protection and the U.S. Marine Mammals Act was passed, so all of these species are now protected. Harbor seals have recovered pretty well in the North Sound, in Hood Canal, and in the South Sound. In the main basin, the area around Seattle, there are no breeding populations of harbor seals. There are no haul-outs for harbor seals where they live in breeding colonies. In the North Sound, the populations have been increasing, and I think it's 6% a year. No, North Sound, 14% a year. Hood Canal, they've been increasing at the rate of 5% a year. And in the South Sound at the rate of 19% per year. So they're going up pretty fast. The South Sound was the area most heavily hit by bounty hunters. So there's really more room for the population to increase in the South Sound. And they're estimated to be somewhere around 1,500 harbor seals in the South Sound. And they have three major breeding areas in the South Sound. One of them is just on the north side of McNeil Island at Gertrude Island. And in that area, for any boaters who happen to travel around there, you can see lots of them. And there are reefs or rocky areas where at low tide, lots of them will haul out. Likewise, down by Olympia at Henderson Inlet, there's a little bay where a lot of them haul out. And they're starting to have a lot of human seal interactions, both people harassing the seals and people just going out to look at the seals. And because of that, they're actually beginning to restrict boating in part of one specific bay to help protect the seals. In Hood Canal, people are not happy about the seals in the vicinity of the Dos Wallops, something I mentioned in answer to a question last time, because the seals are hauling out on the clam beds. They're providing fecal material to the clam beds, and the clams thus have high levels of bacteria in them, levels that are considered above those safe for human consumption. And so the beaches are closed for clam digging. Well, that doesn't make people very happy. So what they're trying to do this summer is build some offshore haul-out areas so the seals will haul out off there instead of onshore on the clam beds, and they're waiting to see if that works very well. Yeah?
Diversion from that topic, but in that general area, what about all the salmon growing beds that apparently produce a lot of fish?
Salmon net pens.
Yeah, are those on whole better or worse than?
Salmon net pens are essentially a lot like cattle feedlots. And we have cattle feedlots around Ellensburg, and we eat a lot of cattle from there.
salmon net pens can be sighted well or they can be sighted poorly. And many of the first ones that were sighted in Puget Sound were sighted exceptionally poorly. And because of that, under the net pens, there's basically a solid layer of fecal material, and the area is considered dead. Department of Natural Resources has been doing some pretty intensive surveys under net pens this summer because they're very concerned, because of course the Department of Natural Resources owns the bottom of the sound in trust for us. And initially they've been saying, it's okay, it's gonna be okay. This summer they didn't find such good stuff down there. Net pens need to be situated in areas where there's really good circulation. And as such, you know, it's not bad. But when you consider that a feedlot in Ellensburg must have a permit to discharge its wastewater, it's also considered necessary for a net pen to have a permit because of the waste it's putting into the water. Now, the Department of Ecology has taken the point of view that they have to collect that waste and take it out of there. Well, it's not easy to do when you're in an area that's circulating well in the open ocean. So the Department of Ecology has basically taken the position that net pens really don't belong in Puget Sound. So that's kind of a long-winded answer to say that it's still extremely controversial. The final result isn't in yet, but at least one state agency has taken the position it's not a good idea. DNR is kind of mixed feelings because they'd like to lease the land, but they don't want their land to get their bottom to get dirty in the process. Counties are a mixed lot. Some counties, county commissioners are going along with them, some county commissioners are strongly opposing them. And there are a lot of upshore landowners who very much oppose them for aesthetic reasons. Sea lions are the marine mammals that have been munching on the sockeyes in particular. They munch on other fishes, on other salmon species as well. And fishermen don't like to pull their line up and find their fish half eaten because the sea lion got it while it was on the hook. But that does happen. Part of the reason sea lions have become basically a nuisance in Puget Sound is because we haven't built fish ladders right. The way fish ladders, or ways to move fish from one elevation to another, have been constructed very often funnels the fish right into an area where the sea lions can just come in and munch away. And so many fish ladders need to be redesigned, and after they're redesigned, that's not so much of a problem. Likewise, the state agencies have taken to harassing the marine mammals, and in some cases hauling them back to California to move them off, but they can find their way back here quite effectively. In terms of the whale species, the harbor porpoise is an interesting one. Back before 1940, it was a general resident of all of Puget Sound. Today, it no longer exists anywhere in Puget Sound except in the San Juan Islands and the Straits Juan de Fuca, and then out on the open ocean coast. In the state of Washington, it's estimated that we have about 8,800 of them, so the stocks are pretty good. But for some reason, they've completely left the main basin of Puget Sound. There's also some indication that they're having a much higher rate of reproductive failure. Killer whales, our population was cut in half in the late 1960s and early 1970s when marine parks like Marineland and SeaWorld were coming to Puget Sound to catch killer whales. When it was cut in half, a small portion of those actually ended up in marine parks, and many more were either killed in the process of trying to capture them or died very shortly after they were captured or in transit to marine parks. 1976, with the Marine Mammal Protection Act, all harvest of killer whales was stopped. Our stocks of killer whales are pretty much stable. Any of you who are really into killer whales, I highly recommend the Whale Museum at Friday Harbor, which keeps track of absolutely every killer whale in Puget Sound. And not only can you adopt a killer whale, they'll give you a picture of your adopted killer whale and list your name, etc. Killer whales live on the average of 50 to 65 years. Many of them reside permanently up in the San Juan Islands, but they do cruise south into the South Sound, and periodically we'll see them off Tacoma or even further south in the Sound. And it seems like when they cruise south, they're on holiday. They think they're basically out for recreation when they cruise south. And likewise, different pods or groups of them mix together when they come on their southern cruises. Like I say, the Whale Museum has some really nifty displays of that movement of killer whales. Killer whales that live in Puget Sound tend not to eat seals and sea lions. Rather, they tend to eat fish. The killer whales live more in the open ocean and occasionally visit Puget Sound but are not resident, tend to eat seals and sea lions. So there's some thought if those populations ever came back, maybe we'd begin to get the population of these in balance with the population of their main predator. Any questions, comments on marine mammals? I think it's really exciting that there are marine mammals in Puget Sound. About two years ago, just off the north end of Bainbridge Island, I saw a school of about 40 Dahl's porpoise.
I saw them too a couple years ago.
Yeah. It was the same porpoise. Yeah.
I'm always curious about the social structure. Have anybody ever determined that killer whales actually have those like little local languages within a pod, and one pod can only speak moderately to another pod because
they have differences in their vocal communications from pod to pod, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But they can seem to talk to each other a little bit. Yeah. Gray whales, good thing you mentioned that. I kind of forgot that. Gray whales have been migrating into Puget Sound at a higher rate. It's estimated that there were about 16 in Puget Sound this summer altogether, and previous summers it's been a few. It's been growing each summer. We've also had a higher rate of fatality in Puget Sound in the last few summers. What's causing those deaths, nobody really knows. You've probably heard stories about their livers blowing up and that they were full of toxic chemicals, et cetera, when their stomach contents were analyzed. I heard one report last year that there was a lot of bismuth in a whale's stomach. Bismuth is a metal. Yeah, Pepto-Bismol, stuff that's used to make the intestinal tract opaque when you're getting an x-ray, you know, that kind of thing. Maybe the whale had an x-ray, I don't know, but there's no indication that it's actually toxic chemicals that are killing these whales, but likewise, it's still always a possibility. The baleen whales, particularly the gray whales, feed by scooping up the stuff on the bottom. And you may have seen some footage on TV a couple of months ago, taken just north of Everett, where they found at low tide, you could find all of these circular depressions in water about this deep, where these giant gray whales at high tide had just come through and gone scoop, 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 and basically sieve the sediments and spit out what they don't want. The feeding footage is really pretty fantastic that's been collected in the last year or so. But you know, who knows what's killing them? There's some thought that part of the reason some gray whales come into Puget Sound is because as they're migrating north, they don't feel very well, you know, that they're sick. And so they come into Puget Sound as a place to rest. They cruise around for a while, and some of them die. Some of them go back out and head on north or head on south. So it's a very open question. The Cascadia Research Consortium in Olympia is the most active whale research organization in Puget Sound, and they're spending a lot of time trying to pay some attention to gray whales. And they've started taking, whenever they find a dead gray whale and they have the money, they'll take some head core samples to get at some of the little bones, the oliths and stuff in the ear, and think that they can tell some about how well the whales, what the whale's health is like.
I'm going to ask you how often autopsies are done on these.
Very seldom. Autopsies are done almost never for two main reasons. One, very often when somebody finds the whale dead, it's been dead for a while. and so taking tissues for histopathology isn't worth a whole lot. Two, it costs a lot of money to do an autopsy on a whale. And all the money has basically been dug up on an emergency basis after the dead whale's been found. And because of that, again, you know, collecting samples doesn't buy you a whole lot. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has taken almost no samples on dead whales.
Is that a bad idea? I mean, would it be useful if they did? Mm-hmm. You'd find out a lot more about why they died.
It'd be useful if they did.
What range of expense is it to do a set of basic samples?
To do a suite of chemicals, say on one tissue sample, all of the priority pollutants, for instance, which include organics and inorganic chemicals, could cost you as much as $2,200, and that's after you get the sample out of the whale. So.
So in total, what would a useful autopsy cost?
They've tried to do them for $10,000 and haven't really succeeded. So, you know, to get a whale to do an autopsy, you've got to get it up somewhere where you can, you know, get into it, etc. So it means tugboats, maybe. It means cats, winches, trucks. Not like doing
it. Dispose of a whale.
There are a couple of ways they dispose of a whale. It depends on whether or not they want the skeleton. Museums love whale skeletons. So often, if they're going to try and get the skeleton, if they can get it on a flatbed truck and haul it to some area, they'll flense it out or cut as much of the meat off it, of it as they can, basically let it sit there and rot and then hose it off. It's a real pleasant process. If they're just going to get rid of it, they take a cat, dig a hole in the sand, and bury it in the beach. Towing them out to sea doesn't work. They used to try that. They always wash up somewhere.
Much to people's dismay.
If we take a look at benthic sediments or bottom sediments, you can see some pretty dramatic changes as you go from normal, healthy bottoms to areas on the bottom that are very polluted. And you can see the scale here in terms of depth. You just don't find stuff growing as deep or organisms burrowing as deep. But in addition, you find some very definite species changes. You lose the species that are pollution sensitive, and you're left with species that are pollution tolerant. And many of the species that are pollution sensitive tend to be good food species for organisms up the food web. So the changes that occur, you may still have a lot of stuff growing here, living there, but it may be just a very few species. In freshwater sediments, there are organisms called sludge worms. You get a lot of sludge, you get a lot of sludge worms. I remember when I was living in Chicago and they took off up a cubic yard of sediment off the Wilmette, Illinois outfall, they found a cubic yard of sludge worms. Well, it doesn't happen quite that way in marine waters, but you do get fewer and fewer species that are present until ultimately you can get to areas that are essentially sterile. In the area I was talking about off of the Simpson-Tacoma Kraft plant in Tacoma, was essentially sterile, nothing living there at all before they did their habitat restoration. Some of the species that can exist in this region right here include fucus, or the big brown algae. It's very pollution tolerant, as are mussels. So as you get populations that have high levels of mussels and fucus, you know you've probably begun to get some pollution problems. They're indicator species for beginning to have pollution problems in an area.
But mussels are still safe to eat?
As long as the mussels come from a clean area, yeah. Mussels being filter feeders will take up both chemicals and bacteria, just like clams could take up chemicals and bacteria. Mussels from a polluted area are not safe to eat. I wouldn't eat mussels from Commencement Bay. Just a couple of minutes on habitat changes. Along Puget Sound, when people came to settle, they found river mouths as really nice places to settle. River mouths are also the areas with our intertidal habitats that I've been talking about, the salt marshes and the mudflats. Well, Duwamish in Seattle is a really good example, where in 1854, a look at the Duwamish River showed something very, very different from to what today is Duwamish River. For those of you from the area, the West Seattle Bridge crosses somewhere right in here. We have Harbor Island, which I'll talk about in a minute, and a very straight channelized body of water with the East Waterway and the West Waterway. In 1854, we had a very meandering body of water that moved through there. And as you can see out here, lots of shallows and tide flats off of the mouth of the river, followed by tidal marshes and tidal swamps upstream. If you take a look at the mean low, low water contour, or a measure of where the mean low tide is, you can see it runs right across here. Okay, keep that picture in mind and take a look at the picture from 1985. Like I said, notice we have one meander right here. For those of you familiar with Seattle, you might remember there was a drive-in theater that used to be built right here, and it's now a little office park. You can kind of see it when you look south from Tukwila. And then beyond that, essentially you've got a straight shot in east and west waterways. Harbor Island, right here, didn't exist before. And shallows and mudflats, you can see almost none of. Tidal marshes, you can see a little bit right here. That's Kellogg Island, and a couple of little spots, pretty tiny spots upstream. As well as a real change in terms of developed area, with most of this now being developed floodplain and shorelands, a fair number of sewer overflows, which are those outlets for Seattle because it has combined sewers. So when you have sewage and rainstorms and the rainwater gets mixed with the sewage, there's too much to go to the treatment plants. So these are like the emergency overflows where it comes out. Likewise, a fair number of storm drains, and also a variety of industries that have discharges. We take a look at Commencement Day. Oh, I just realized I forgot my maps. I had a series of maps, but anyway, Commencement Bay is a very similar story. The red line across here is the 1854 waterfront. What you see superimposed on that is how the Tacoma estuary has been dredged and filled. Again, there's almost no original intertidal habitat left. At the mouth of the Puyallup River, right here, is where the Simpson-Tacoma Craft Company has rebuilt 16 acres of mudflat. It's essentially the only 16 acres of mudflat in Commencement Bay, with the exception of one small mudflat right here, which is now owned by the Puyallup Indians, and a very highly contaminated mudflat up this waterway right here. It's so contaminated, it's basically sterile. Nothing lives there. And in addition, the Port of Tacoma has built one small waterway, one small wetland right about here, and they built it because they illegally filled a wetland that existed right here. That brings me to restoration. Those are two examples of restoration in Puget Sound, where we've actually begun to reverse the trend and rebuild habitat that's disappeared over the last 140 years. This habitat out here is 3 years old. It's being accurate, it's being monitored pretty regularly. Yeah.
Where did mine stop? Well, I can't understand what you mean or anybody means when they say rebuild habitat. Or how do you do the same thing? You find the same mud somewhere under the dump and bring it back?
What was done in this case out here was the area had been dredged to be deep water to bring barges in there. The dredged area had filled up or had been covered with contaminated sediments as well as lots and lots of wood chips that had blown off their wood piles and from poor handling of the wood chips. So what they did was they took all the contamination, scooped it up, and there was one depression and they plopped it all down there. This is under the water.
Plopped what down there?
The contamination. Then they hydraulically pumped clean river sediments from the Puyallup River, and there's a lot of sediments in here, over here, and filled the area up 10 to 12 feet with clean sediments, and then recontoured it. They didn't do any planning here at all. They just let whatever would naturally move in, move in. And in 3 years, a lot has moved in. So that's what I mean by restoration. It really does seem to have worked so far. It wasn't cheap by any stretch of the imagination. But if you go out there, you can find some of those pollution-tolerant species, and you can also begin to find some of the species that are not particularly pollution-tolerant, like some of the copepods. I actually found a clam out there one day. Yeah?
Where did they dump the bad stuff in?
It's buried. It's buried anywhere from...
Land.
It's buried right out here.
In the water.
It's buried directly under what their new habitat is because it had previously been dredged out, and so they piled it down there to help build up. And of course, the reason they buried it is because of expense. To take it upshore and treat it is basically an untenably expensive process today. Nobody, one, knows how to do it, and two, even if they did know how to do it, it'd be awful expensive. The wetland that was built down here has not been so successful. University of Washington ecologists planted it, and they used their best judgment, and they're the best people around, and it just hasn't really taken off like they'd hoped. And part of the problem, they feel, is that up this dredged river, it's basically isolated from any other similar habitat. So for species to move in, particularly the critters that live in the mud in the bottom, it just hasn't happened. So birds are using it, and the reeds are looking pretty good, but the rest of the habitat doesn't look too great. Well, it's time for me to wrap up here. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to take any questions individually afterward.